This podcast is sponsored by Brighton's own Bison Beer. The homegrown boys have been championing Sussex superstars for over 5 years already and are currently delivering 7 days a week with a free same-day service to the local area. Check out their lock-in box, which we're sampling this week. It's packed with 12 bangers from the best in the business, including Burning Sky, Unbarred and Arundel. Just pop in the code BHAFC when checking out on their website for 10% off your first order. Get your refreshments now at bisonbeer.co.uk. That's bisonbeer.co.uk. Hello, welcome to episode 7 of Football, the Albion and Me. I'm Richard Newman. Hope you're all enjoying the podcast so far. If you're new to all of this, you're very welcome. Do catch up on our previous episodes with Gary Nelson, Tommy Elphick, Peter Ward, Bob Booker, Stuart Storer and Gary Dicker. The idea of these podcasts is to mostly try and make sure they're not too time specific so you can enjoy them at any time. We're moving on to this week's podcast, and I was delighted to record this interview with Guy Butters in April 2020. As always in the podcast, Guy picks his ultimate five-a-side team from former teammates in Jumpers for Goalposts. He also spoke about his time at Tottenham with Paul Gascoigne and Chris Waddle, his journey to Albion, and how Mark McGee prolonged his career. We'll come to your time at the Albion shortly, but as always on the podcast, we're going to start at the very beginning and find out where a career in football really came from. So am I right in saying you grew up in Hillingdon?
Yeah, West London.
What was life like in your household growing up?
Yeah, really good. I had a great childhood, really. It's probably the perfect place to grow up, really. It was sort of on the outskirts of London. And it was, I don't know if you've ever been around that area, it's sort of near enough to town to get into, but also you're sort of right on the outskirts, so you're not far away from places like Watford, etc., Harefield, where it's nice and rural. So it had a really good mixture. And I was very, very lucky to be brought up into a family that loves sport. My dad played football and cricket for his local, his company that he worked for, his local firm's team. So he'd play in goal in the winter, and he'd be a wicketkeeper in the summer. So he's very good with his hands. For a company called Sanderson's, used to make the wallpapers and the paints and that, and curtains and that. So we used to go down there, watch him play in the winter, and basically joined in. And I had an older brother who's about five years older than me. So we used to go down and watch my dad play football. But obviously with all the other people that were playing as well, they had children. So there was about eight of us used to play on a side pitch or wherever they were playing. We just find a little bit of ground somewhere and have a kick around. But I can always, ever since year dot, I can always remember having a ball at my feet. I know it sounds like one of them old stupid cliches that everyone trots out, but I can't remember a time where I didn't have a football at my feet or wanted to go out and play football.
So was it always a dream to become a footballer?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, you never sort of, when I grew up, like I say, I used to watch my dad play football. I was very lucky that, you know, they were sort of, they're very good parents. They, you know, I couldn't have had it any better, really. They sort of give me a bit of leeway. They let me stay up and watch Match of the Day on a Saturday, you know. And it's weird, really, because obviously with this lockdown thing now, people finding things to do. But I've just found on BT Sport, they do what a big match revisited and sort of old games. And I remember a lot of them when I was young, you know, big matches on a Sunday. But I always remember on watching Match of the Day with my family on a Saturday night, even from a really young age, and watching games from, you know, the sort of the top division. They used to show games from each division. So when you sort of grew up, I was always around football, always around sport. Anything that was on the telly sport-wise, my family had it on. And like I say, in them days, you never had computer games. So it was school holidays, you was always over the park. And again, all the old cliches are rattled out. You do literally used to go and have your breakfast and get out in the morning over the park, come back for lunch, back over the park again and come home when it was dark, you know, and have your dinner or whatever. And that's the way it was. That's the way life was. We had a load of kids down our street. I lost count of the amount of windows I broke down our street, playing football in the street. But, you know, like you said, that's what it was. That's what it was like growing up in the 70s and 80s.
Did you support anyone in particular?
It's a weird one, really, because my brother, he had a big... But he was very sort of supportive of Man United for some reason. He used to love the football kits and that. And me personally, I used to support whoever won the FA Cup, because the FA Cup in them days was massive. It was like a, You know, I thought that was better than the league, the FA Cup. The whole day as well, it was devoted on the cup final day. The whole day of programming on the telly was devoted from, you know, breakfast. They had breakfast with the players. Used to get comedians stand outside the hotel and shout things up to them. They're all hanging out the windows. And they used to show them on the coach to the walls of the game. So there's a massive build-up for the whole game. So I used to support really whoever won the FA Cup. I used to get a nice, like, you know, my birthday was in October, so I'd get the kit. Whoever won the FA Cup, normally 70s, 80s, it was mainly, you know, it was a lot of Man United. It was the odd Arsenal. You know, obviously early 80s was in your Tottenhams, but I always remember growing up thinking, I just used to love kits. It was weird. You know, don't you remember the old Welsh
kids
kit?
Kids do, they, right?
Yeah, it was exactly the same as the old Welsh kit. It was exactly the same as the old Coventry kit. Yeah. But it was lovely red, and it had like yellow stripes with a bit of green in it and a bit of black. And I got that for Christmas one year. You know, Wales kit. Not even Welsh. My parents weren't well off by any, you know, stretch of the imagination. They were hard working class family. But whatever money they did have, you know, they obviously wanted to make sure that they treated me and my brother, which was brilliant. Like I say, growing up in that sort of environment, and you know, even the area in them days, it was weird because there's, you know, you could walk down the street and you used to cross over the road if you see an older kid coming the other way, because 9 times out of 10 he'll end up chasing down the road trying to give you a bit of a kicking. That's just the way it was in London in them days. So you had to live on your wits going to school. You know, we used to have the old year above you at break time trying to run after you and try and get hold of you and shove grass down your back or whatever it be. You know, typical things that kids did in them days, but you had to live on your wits. And it always helped having a brother that was sort of 4 or 5 years older than you, you know, to be around. You know, even sort of in junior school where I grew up, I went to a place called Woodland Park Primary School in Hayes. The schoolmaster there, the football schoolmaster, Ian Jerome, he brilliant for me because he sort of realised I was always quite big for my age. He put me into the year above team. We had a very good squad. I've got a picture on Facebook somewhere of us winning the league. So I'm with the kids that are year above me, and we have Phil Parks coming to present the medals. I looked at the picture the other day, and it's a real like Bash Street kids. You know, we've got all the holes hanging out of our trousers, and you know, some of the gear that we've got on. It was right rough and ready, but great days. And like I say, he done brilliant for me because he played me in the year above. So I was really tested, you know, obviously being a younger kid and playing against kids a year older than me in a really good league, school league. I had to muck in and survive. I started off left wing, believe it or not. I was the only kid in the school really who was left footed, apart from maybe one other who played centre midfield. So yeah, they bunged me out on the left wing.
Would you say that he had quite an influence on your career then? Really early age, you know, he's obviously given you some sort of confidence.
Massively. Yeah, he was hard but fair. You know, he you'd done well for him and you behaved in class and that, and you was playing. And he'd back you, you know, if it was a case of sometimes, you know, the headmistress had found out that you'd been, you know, she'd found out that you'd been a bit naughty or something, you're not playing, he would back you, you know, he would fight your corner for you. And, yeah, but as a manager, you know, like I say, showing faith in putting a kid in with, because there were some good players, you know, the year above, and he showed faith in me by putting me in. Not many people would have done that. But he was brilliant. He was someone that I really looked up to. And, you know, he was always there for you.
Did you enjoy school?
I did, yeah, I did. I enjoyed it to a certain extent because I was very lucky, like I said, with the way I was brought up. My mum was, she held down 3 jobs. She worked in the nursery. There was where the schools were. We had a church that was a nursery. Right next door to that was the infant school. And then right next door to that was the junior school. So she used to go in the morning and work in the nursery school. Then when she finished that, she'd walk across to the infant school and was a dinner lady. So all the pupils knew her, all the kids, all my mates knew her. And everyone sort of liked my mum anyway. So I was very lucky that way. And then obviously, you know, you had junior school next door, which I went to eventually. But then after that, in the evening, she used to work for Securicor, go and help out working, counting the money for Securicor. So she held down 3 jobs, plus looking after a household as well. You know, my dad was, he's both still alive. They both live near me, but he was sort of old school. You know, he'd come home from work, shoes off, where's my dinner? That sort of thing. You know, the dinner was on the table. You know, and there's none of this stuff that's around nowadays. There's no education in them days. It literally was because you'd been done or previously done two jobs, then had to come home, cook dinner. It was get a chip pan on, you know what I mean? Bang, there you go. It was either chips or mash or something. And then she'd be off to work again, like say in the evening. That's the way it was. There was no education on diets, etc. But like I said, you weren't just sat in all day either playing on PlayStation or anything like that. You were out running it off. My dad, eventually when he got a bit older and he couldn't play football, cricket anymore, he took up lawn bowls. So they had a lawn bowls team as well. And there was a massive social club right on it. So he used to go down, I'm going for a bowl up every night, really, near enough. But you knew what he was doing. He was going for a bowl up, but he wanted to go down and have a couple of pints with his mate. But it was about three and a half miles away. So I used to literally every night say to him, I used to put a towel and some clothes in the car and I'd run there. He'd drive to it, obviously, but I'd run there the 3.5 miles. It was probably more than that, 4 miles. And so I used to run there. That was my fitness work. And there was a couple of massive meals on the way there. You were eating probably not food that was great for you, but you know, like I said, you were constantly active. I can't remember a time where I was ever really indoors watching telly. I was just fidgeting or something. I was always keen to get out and play sport.
Can you remember the first match that you went to?
As most kids did then in them days, I joined a Sunday team, you know, called Alpine Miners. And again, two people who had massive influence on me as well, again, in them days, Mark Branch. He was the brother of one of my best mates, Lee, who was in the same team as me. And the manager was a bloke called Norman Fleming. And them two, again, you know, every Friday night, we used to train over the park, games on a Sunday. And I always remember Mark and his brother, Lee. They were massive Arsenal fans. I remember one day they asked me if I wanted to go and I asked my mum and she said no. It was like a school handball tournament on in a local gym. So I'd volunteered for that and she said, no, you've got to play handball. You can't let them down now. So I remember like being really sort of upset about that because I'd never been to a football match before. And all of a sudden I'm playing the handball tournament and this Mark Branch turned up and said, look, I've rung your mum up and I've asked your school teacher and they said you can go. We got knocked out, as it was, in the handball thing. So I was sort of standing around anyway. So we went to watch Arsenal play. I can't even remember who they played, to be fair. But I always remember right next to the dugouts. They had like a children's area, family area. Yeah. So I was right next to the dugouts. And always the thing that struck me about it, in them days, the camber on the pitch, you know, they used to have to keep the water off. It was their way of keeping all the water off the pitch was to have it like a massive sort of like a hill in the middle. So the water run down the side. So when the ball was on the other side of the pitch, you can only see people from their knees up. It was weird. Couldn't see the ball. But I always remember that. It was like a full house. And we hung around afterwards. And he had a piece of paper on him, Mark. He gave it to me and Lee, his brother. And we ended up getting a few signatures from a couple of the Arsenal players. I remember Dave O'Leary playing. I remember getting his signature. Great experience to go and watch Arsenal. And it gave me a little bit of a bug, really. I wanted to go and watch a few more games after that.
I mean, obviously, you had that feeling when you were younger, when you were a child, going to go and watch this game and that sort of raw emotion of like, you know, this is the first time you've gone to a match like this before. You're getting those autographs at the end as well. When you're then a professional later on, could you draw yourself back to that point?
I could, in the fact that when I said before, when we won the league at school and Phil Parks came in, I remember what everyone was like in awe, you know, even my teacher, my dad. Was a massive West Ham fan, you know, to see someone like Phil Parks walk in. And it was, I remember the effect that it had on people around, you know, the adults. And I always remember the influence that he had and the respect and the actual, you know, the way that people reacted around him, the reaction that he created just by turning up and being an actual footballer. By that stage, like I say, I was probably 10, 11. And it was a case of, this is what I want to be now. I want to be a footballer. So when I was a footballer, I always remembered sort of going, you know, that effect that you can have on supporters. We used to have a lot of open days when we played, you know, training days, etc. So afterwards, you'd be signing autographs for fans, etc. And I always remember, you know, I've witnessed a couple of people walk off, you know, they've had enough sort of thing. They've signed a few and then they want to go and get changed. I always made a point of staying there. I always made a point of staying there right to the end until everyone had had whatever they wanted. And I'd even be off, say, anyone else, you know, anyone want anything, I'd go out of my way to do something. I've just felt that was what the respect I had to give back, if you know what I mean. I'd sort of, you know, when I was younger, whatever, at Spurs, people paid money to come and watch you play. You know what I mean? It's the big fans, you know, you owe them that respect. To sort of, if they want autographs, if they want me to do something, I'll do it. And I think later on in my career, I think that's had a massive influence, the fact that where I work for the community scheme as well, and the stuff that we do at the community scheme. I've always wanted to do something like that, you know, help people out.
Let's go on to the start of your professional career then. You signed with Tottenham, having spent some of your youth career there. Can you remember when you first joined Spurs and what the feelings were like?
I remember when the route there, when I was young, you know, you represent your district, first of all, and then you represent your county, which was Middlesex. And then, you know, you're coming into, you're meeting other players from, a couple of them you recognise from Sunday football, but others that you know, the other side of London that you don't recognise. And then playing for London schoolboys as well, things like that. So you're coming up against more competitive players that you're competing with to get in the team, and then you're obviously competing against other counties. So you're playing against Surrey's and Essex, and you know, and this is you're meeting kids that are on sort of West Ham's books and things like that. So at the time, I wasn't on anyone's books. I always remember after a game, my mum and dad talking to some bloke, and just got in the car, and they went. I heard them talking. I said, "Who's that then?" And they said, "I was a Tottenham scout. They've invited you along one day a week on a Monday evening." To come train. The logistics of that, from West London to North London, sort of the time I had to be there was a bit of a nightmare because my dad had to leave work early and we had to rush our way sort of round the North Circular all the way round to Tottenham. It was a nightmare time, really, in a way, for my dad, because he sort of didn't even go home. He used to have quickly run in, grab a roll or something when we were out the door. I was back home from school, get changed, bosh in the car, all the way over to London, the other side of London, and then train, and then didn't get home until probably 9, 10 o'clock at night, straight to bed, knackered. But yeah, so great sacrifice from my parents, massively. Always remember that, doing that from the age of probably, I think I was 11, doing that for a year. And then when you get to 12, then they decided whether they're going to take you on schoolboy forms. 12 till 14, I'd done that on a Monday. And then when you get to 14, they decided whether they're going to take you on schoolboy forms, which fortunately they did, and then got to so that's for 2 years. So that means then you can't play football on a Sunday because all their games were on a Sunday, so you had to leave your Sunday team, which, you know, obviously is a bit of a gutter for you because you've got mates there and the manager's sort of pleading with you to stay. You're sort of trying to convince him that no, I'd rather go and play for Tottenham, to be honest. So you were playing a lot of games there for 2 years and travelling in, really. There was quite a few of us. There was probably about three or four of us all from the same area that were at Tottenham on their books at the same time. So we used to take it in turns, the parents drive us in. Over the sort of months, all of a sudden one of them would get released. So there's only three of you going in, then someone else would get released. So there's two of you going in, and eventually you find yourself, you're the only one going in. So it's quite hard growing up in that environment, seeing your mates getting put to the wayside, some of them. And then obviously they make their mind up whether they're going to take you on as an apprentice. And that year that they did, 86, I think it changed. I think it went on to YTS. The government funded it. I think there must have been a good sort of 15 of us end up signing for YTS there. And yeah, brilliant. Unfortunately, obviously, because the logistics of being across the other side of London, I had to stay in digs. So I was sort of scrambling around looking for digs. And one of the other players, Steve Smart, his family very kindly offered to put me up there. So I was sort of moved in now, first day, which was another almighty challenge, because the very first day you get given jobs when you're young, you know, like put balls and bibs out or clean something up. And I remember David Pleat had just taken over the first team as manager, but he was away on holiday, so his assistant Trevor Hartley was there, and he called a mass team meeting, so everyone had to go in, all the pros, all the apprentices. And so by the time we got in there, all the seats had been taken, we were sat on the floor. He started doing a massive talk about whatever, and he started talking about discipline. And then he went, "You," and I don't know whether it was because I was the biggest one or not, he made me stand up, nearly lifted me off my feet, staggered back, and obviously just stunned. And he went, "Brilliant, no retaliation, sit down." So everyone's wet themselves laughing. I think he'd done it as an icebreaker for them, right, and a little, you know, for the pros, but also as a little bit of a warning to the young lads, this is what you are, you know, you're down on the bottom rung of a ladder, that sort of thing. Yeah. So then, straight after that meeting, we've gone out, everyone was mixed in together, and we were doing a warm-up together, and we were sort of like in and out of each other. But, you know, that's the way it was in them days, you know, you never get away with that now, obviously.
No, what do you think, though, when that happened, when that happened? Because obviously, as you say, you thought it might be for everyone else, but for you...
Yeah, I mean, you know, you find it weird, but to be honest, the sort of the year before, when I was still at school, you know, in them days, you had a youth team, you had a reserves, and you had a first team. So if you were good enough to play in the youth team, and the reserves were short, you could be 16, 17, and you could be playing in the reserves against 33-year-old men. And the year before, when I was still at school, like I said, the reserves had a behind-closed-doors fixture against Arsenal. I think we should try and get a couple of people back depth of injury and whatever, and give some one or two of bit of fitness. And I was literally just turned 16, probably 15, 16, and I was trapped in against Arsenal reserves, and they had Paul Mariner up front. So I'm getting elbowed in the face, left, right, centre from Paul Mariner. But I think they do it to look for reactions, partly to see if you can cope with it, and partly to see what your reaction is to dealing with that sort of pressure. And so when he done that, it was okay. This is, you know, I wasn't expecting it, obviously, but this is the way life is. You know where you are. That is that test. You sort of walk away thinking, is he testing me there? Is he looking at my reaction? I don't know. What can I do? What do I do? Go home and cry? If I want to be a footballer, have I got to put up with this? Or, do you know what I mean? That sort of thing. That's what sort of goes through your mind. And then it's not nice being away from home, because the first night you're away from home anyway, first time I've left home. You know, young 16-year-old kid just left school away from home from my family and that, and someone's whacked you around the face. My aim was to be a professional footballer. And if I had to go through that to get it, that's what I was going to go through.
After you made your debut, you ended up playing quite regularly, didn't you, under Terry Venables for a while?
Yeah, I mean, even that on my debut was an eye-opener, really, because previous 2-3 days before, we played a League Cup game against Blackburn away, and he said I scored an own goal. The bloke flicked it on, hit me on the head and went in. I couldn't really do much about it, but we won. So I was sub on the bench against Wimbledon, but I weren't really sure because I knew there was a few injuries. So some bloke from the Daily Star thought I might be playing. So the day before, he just interviewed me and just said, "What do you fancy playing against John Fashion?" And I said, "Well, look, I prefer someone who's big and tall and strong rather than someone who's small and quick." And that was it. I woke up the next day. My dad used to buy the Daily Star anyway. He's come in and gone, "What have you said?" Look, 3 pages in, "I can't wait to bash Fash," or something like that. And something ridiculous on there. And I answered that. Anyway, I got down to the ground and I was sort of hanging around outside the changing room, because when you're young, you sort of still don't want to go in the changing room because they get you to do the little rubbish jobs. So I sort of hung outside in the corridor, and I heard all the Wimbledon players come in. So I went and hid in the boot room. So I hid in the boot room while I went past, went in the changing room. Then I come out, and then the manager, Bobby Gordon, down the thing, and he's sort of acknowledging all the stewards and the, you know, all that tea ladies. And then he cuts me. He went, "All right, big man." I went, "All right." He went, "Watch your teeth." sort of crumbled. Oh, God. So I went into the changing room, told one of the other subs and that, Paul Moran, and he blurred it out with everyone. Everyone started laughing anyway. So I come on a sub when Gary Stevens, Vinnie Jones tackle, quite famous Vinnie Jones tackle on Gary Stevens, and I come on a sub for him, and luckily scored in the right net that time and done quite well. But like you say, yeah, played the rest of the season in that team, and we started off pretty badly, but we ended up finishing quite well. I think we finished fourth or something in the end. Might be wrong, but it's good, because obviously you had Gascoigne and Chris Waddell in the team with Gary Mabbutt, all them sort of players, you know, amazing. And Terry Fenwick, and, you know, international season, international, Chris Hughton playing alongside you, you know. You got all these people talking to you and telling you what to do and helping you out. It was brilliant.
So you played a lot that season, but then the opportunities dried up a little bit, didn't they? And then you ended up going on loan for a bit before you joined Pompey.
I just signed a 4-year contract, and so I was in the team. Chris Hughton was sort of, I think he might have gone, or he was left out of the team. Gary Mabbutt got injured. I think Fenn might have got injured a little bit as well. So it was big upheaval in the team. They just signed Steve Sedgley as well from, I think, Coventry for big money. So I was getting different people around me, and I didn't have that support network around me, I felt, because Pat Vandenel would sort of, you know, he was an attacking fullback. He was on his bike. He wanted to go forward. So I found myself isolated a couple of times and sort of not really having people around me, like a comfort blanket, really. So I sort of struggled a little bit, a couple of games. And it wasn't like really bad drop of form. The odd sort of game I'd do really well. The odd game it was like, you know, could have done better sort of thing. I think Steve Sedgley was playing in midfield as well at the time, and I don't think he was settling in. So we had a couple of bad results, and it culminated then with them saying, "Well, okay, we dropped Sedge back in the centre-half. Not a problem. You know, these things happen." But then you find yourself sort of on the bench, still in the squad, and then all of a sudden you're not in the squad because they needed an extra forward in there or something. So they take a defender out, so all of a sudden you're out, you're not even in the squad. And you think, well, how did all this escalate so quick? You know what I mean? One of them things. I had a few off-field troubles at the time, which, you know, happens, but we played Southend in the League Cup or something. Played in the first leg at home, done okay. Second leg, on the way to the game, we stayed over in a hotel night before, got food poisoning. So I was being sick on the way to the game, so I couldn't play, obviously. So like I said, they put Sedge back centre-half, and then they liked the look of Justin Edinburgh played in the team for Southend. So then the chance come up for them to get him on loan, and they said, do you want to go the other way? And I just thought, well, I'm playing reserve football. I might as well go and play some sort of competitive football. So I went on loan to Southend under Dave Webb for 3 months, and that was amazing. You know, great time. Brilliant time, to be fair, because you're sort of getting that league football feel back again, playing in front of crowds again. And Dave done really well for me. But when I came back, it was the same again. I was sort of, we went to pre-season abroad. Just, I don't know, things, I sort of didn't feel like I was really going to get a chance. It culminated in, I think it was Ray Clements' testimonial, or someone's testimonial, I think it was Ray Clements's. And I was on the bench, and they said, look, 10 minutes to go, go on, you're going on, warm up. And as I warmed up, you know, testimonials are like, the ball didn't go out. When it went out, it literally, I came on, they took the throw in, and the ref blew the whistle. So I was fuming, really, because I just wanted to get back on and play football. And went in the players' lounge, and a couple of mates in there, you know what mates are like, they just all wet themselves laughing. They really were wet themselves laughing. And I'm quite happy-go-lucky, anyone I tell you. I normally like a laugh and whatever. And for some reason, I don't know why, the more they laugh, the more fuming I got. I weren't having it, this one. I think the next day, I asked for a transfer. Now, looking back on it, I had 3 years left on my contract. So looking back on it, was I hasty? But I just thought I got to get out of here. Things were happening at the club that I didn't like.
When you say, things were happening, are you able to elaborate on what they were?
Not long after, I think all the sort of stuff was happening. I think that was the start of all the money sort of off the pitch things with the club. I think they started to have that light of dissent then, do you know what I mean? And I just felt that, I don't know, things just didn't seem right. I was sort of going in, and once you're out of the team, you are a no one. It's like literally you are a no one again. It's like no one wants to know you. It's like, unless you're in that team, you're an afterthought. On a Friday, day before a game, normally you'd have the team that's not playing play against the first team, you know, and they can stop it and do set pieces, and they do your free kicks, and they do this, that, and the other. They stopped it because they had people like myself and a few others were going over there and wanted, and really saying, I'm going to show you. I want to be in the team. So we were beating them. Sometimes we would be beating the first team. So they put a stop to it. In the end, they got the youth team. They started getting the youth team over to play. You know what I mean? Because they knew that they could beat them. It sounds weird, but... And I was sort of like thinking, well, am I going to get a chance? You're not going to see me play. You're not really going to... You know, Dave Webb, I don't know whether... I think Dave would have put a good report in me on loan because he loved me, Dave Webb. When I was at Portsmouth, he tried to sign me when he became Chelsea manager. He wanted me on loan, but they wouldn't let me go. I don't know, he just felt unwanted. I don't think I was the only one who felt like that. So eventually, you just think, do you know what? Portsmouth come up and I sort of sod it. Why not? Might as well go down there, see what they say. Signed from that very day. Hindsight again, should I have stayed around and fought a bit longer? But you just... Like you say, sometimes you get to the stage where you think, I can't really see myself getting back in.
And briefly, we'll just quickly talk about Pompey and Gillingham, because you spent a long time at both those clubs. What interests me as well, you had some good seasons at both those clubs, but you, as you said earlier on, the FA Cup was just a huge thing for you, and you ended up having pretty good runs at both clubs, didn't you?
Yeah, it did, yeah. But again, it was, you know, looking back on it, it's weird, because I played every game up to the game before the quarterfinals in the FA Cup, and I was playing league games. I think I played 50-something games that season, but in the cup games, for some reason, he wanted to play a back four. So I found myself out of the team just for the cup ones, which was weird because I was playing league games in between. It was strange. It was really strange, but that's the way it was. And then missed the semi-finals, but obviously was there in the crowd, you know, behind the dugout, sort of in the squad. So I made the squad. And then the second game, I think they had a few, might have had another injury, and they, out of me and Gav Maguire was going to be on the bench, they put Gav, so it's the way it goes, isn't it? But I was playing the league games in between. But yeah, great time to be at the club. It was the ticker tape welcomes that they'd done, and the league games we played. And the following season, we lost out in the playoffs to Leicester, which was an offside goal, cheats. But we should have got automatic, really. We floundered a little bit. I think we missed out by one goal or something like that in the end. So we had a real good chance of getting the Premier League. But again, you know, being at a club that maybe gambled a little bit on the playing side and the playing staff that they got in. So after that happened, they ended up having to sell quite a few assets. I think Walshy went. I think Kit Simons went. I think Guy Whittingham went. So we ended up having a few years there where we struggled, really. And it was sort of a case of trying to stay up. But yeah, you know, like I say, a great club. I mean, the fans, unbelievable. You know, talk about fans. We played Le Havre away pre-season. They brought 2,000 fans over. to watch the game. And basically, like I said, because they'd sold a few players, they had a sit-down protest at half-time, got the game called off. So we've gone all the way over to Le Havre, the game called off at half-time. That just got to get a ferry back. You know, amazing times. Great, great club.
Then it was Gillingham, and you were there for 6 years, was it?
Yeah.
More good times there as well. You got to a playoff final, another good cup run.
Yeah, another great club. You know, like I said, I think really I've probably done 6 years at every club I was at. But yeah, it was that game, the Le Havre game, because they had a sit-down protest. Our next game, pre-season friendly, we had to play behind closed doors, and it was drilling them away. And I scored. So I don't know whether Tony then sat up and sort of realised, you know, that I might make a good signing for him. But within a couple of months there, in the season, I got a phone call saying that they're interested in buying me. Go down and talk to them, and I signed on that day. Whether it had a saying on it, Terry Fenwick had taken over at Portsmouth and made me captain. But then, because of the off-field activities, what happened there, they were looking for a new chairman, etc. And then Terry Venables ended up buying the club or being involved in the club. And I always remember coming at the training. I don't know why, really, but Alan Knight, the goalie, like jokingly, just said to me, "Oh, you'll be off then," like that, you know, like a throwaway comment. And I didn't even really think of it. And then I sort of got in the car driving home and I thought, I wonder what he means. And then I sort of like thinking about it more and more, and you think, wow, okay. And then all of a sudden you find yourself sort of not being in the team. It's weird. So then, yeah, I thought, well, again, it's time to go. Fans are very good. Pompey fans, they travelled down to Gillingham, presented me with another lovely tankard and that, and saying thanks for my service for the club, etc., which I thought was a great touch. And then, yeah, so like I say, Tony sold the club for me, told me his vision at Gillingham, what he's got.
Tony Pierce, you know, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, met the chairman, obviously, and liked what they said, liked the two of them straight away, liked the way that they talked. You know, they looked approachable. They looked like they, you know, you do well for them, they look after you, and which was the case. And we built an absolute fantastic squad down there. And not only playing-wise, but good lads, you know, great bunch of lads. Not one. Sometimes you be at clubs and you get the odd one or two, you know, that you don't get on. We've got on well with every single one of them, and we sort of formed massive bonds there. We Tony was a very hard taskmaster, but it wasn't running for running's sake, and it wasn't work for work's sake. There was an element behind. There was a reasoning behind the, you know, all the stuff that you used to do. We never done 1-5 side when I was there. There was no real training session where you could relax. It was constant work and fitness and strength and, you know, organisation. And so much so that he ended up splitting up training. He got the forwards away from the defenders and the midfielders. And he literally sat us all down one day and said, "I'm training them an hour before all you lot. These lot are my cream. They're going to get me promoted. They're going to score the goals and get me promoted. They're the cream. You lot are going to do all the donkey work. You're my ham and eggers," like that. And the name stuck, Eggers. So after every game, we kept a clean sheet. We'd be jumping around the changing room. Eggers. It's brilliant. And it's still, even now, we sort of chuckle about it today. We'll text each other and WhatsApp groups, Eggers. And it's brilliant. We wouldn't be defeated. We used to, if someone knew a forward that they played with at Brentford, like before Carlos Alba and Bob Taylor came to us, they Barry Ashby and Paul Smith and them used to play with them at Brentford. We get it leaked to them that there's a bounty on their heads. The first person who was going to absolutely smash them in the stands would get like a crate of beer or something. And we used to make out that the manager had told us, oh, yeah, it's ridiculous stuff, totally untrue. But we just used to try and send out little messages to people. It was brilliant, great days. I can't explain to you how fun it was.
Great, sounds good.
Even getting in like playoff games, you know, like we've got the Man City game. But even after the playoff games, the semi-finals, as soon as we knew that we were going to Wembley, you know, there was no sort of, okay, right, let's get prepped, this blah, 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 blah. First thought was, right, everyone is out. Everyone is up to nightclubs. Everyone is out. We all stick together. No one's allowed home till 4 o'clock in the morning. You know, just ridiculous things like that. But it, just a great team bonding stuff. You know, loved it.
And while you're at Gillingham, actually, funnily enough, Brighton were actually playing there for a bit. And you joined the Albion in 2002. When did you first hear of any interest and what were your initial thoughts?
That sort of the end of the season before, or sort of midway through, I'd had a bad knee injury. And at one stage, I was thinking, it wasn't like bad, but because I weren't getting a proper rehab, I sort of felt, you know, this could turn quite quickly, this could turn quite serious because I'm not, you know, if I leave things, it's not going to get properly sorted. And one way or another, I missed pre-season, started to play again. And Martin Inchwood, I knew, it was the reserve team manager at Portsmouth when I was there. So I knew Martin from Portsmouth days. And then he'd just taken over at Brighton. And then it was sort of like, one way or another, I was getting contacted saying they're interested in that. And because I lived in Southampton still, where I am now, I was sort of staying up a couple of days a week and travelling the rest of the time. And he sort of said, look, it's nearer home. If you want to go, I'm not going to stand in your way. And, you know, another one again, I could have stayed at Gillingham. I could have thought it out. But I thought, you know what, slightly nearer home, although Brighton's not like, you know, still 70 miles away. Mm-hmm. But yeah, and they just got promoted to the Championship or whatever it was in them days. So I thought, yeah, no problem. Went down there. Totally, realistically looking back on it, should have been honest with them and said to them I wasn't fit. Got put straight into the deep end. Portsmouth, who actually won the league that year. First game, Portsmouth away. Funnily enough, 1-0 up, 1-1, 2-1 up. And then we lost 4-2. I think I gave away a penalty. So I was sort of knackered in the end. But I didn't have the greatest starts because I knew I wasn't fit. I was always playing catch-up with my fitness and we struggled. I think we went X amount of games up without a win and Martin got the sack in the end. Steve Coppell came in. Again, obviously, first game, I think we were playing Sheffield United at home, 2-0 up. They brought on Carlos Alba, they had about four forwards up front. A couple of people give away penalties. Totally nothing to do with me, but I found in the next game, wasn't playing. Was told, no, you're not in my plans. Not really in my plans, to be honest. And they got in another player, Dean Blackwell, I think, from Wimbledon, as a centre-half. And I remember watching Soccer Saturday, and they're playing Crystal Palace away, local derby. They lost 5-0. So you think to yourself, okay, one person's opinion. But I knew I wasn't fit. But I knew, so I went on loan again that season. Martin Allen was at Barnet, went on loan to Barnet. Done quite well there. Felt like I was getting my mojo back, getting my fitness back. I thought, in that close season, the following season, I ended up running, getting fit for pre-season. So I went back to pre-season fit. Got even fitter. And luckily enough, got myself back in the team on one player of the year that year. Yeah. So it just goes to prove, doesn't it? You know, that a lot of it is down to fitness. You know that you don't become a bad player overnight. And you know in your own body what you need. And I needed fitness work. But it was a case of I couldn't really work too hard on my fitness because I had a load of games in between, if you know what I mean. But I knew once I'd get fit, it would work its way out again.
Yeah, what did you think when you first joined the club in terms of, strange time with the stadium and the training facilities, quite unlike anything else that was in the Football League at the time?
Yeah, it was weird because I sort of had that grounding, going along Southend. You know, Southend at the time, they used to buy some of their slips and their training kit from the market outside in the car park. We used to go out there and play like proper match. They were in the old fourth division at the time, lowest division, and there'd be we'd have kit, different shades of shorts, things like that. So, you know, people call it raggy ass, whatever you want to call it, but at the time, it's like I said, I've been slapped in the face first day of training. What do you roll over and die, or do you actually roll your sleeves up and go, do you know what, I'm going to make the best of a bad situation here? Which I think what Brighton did when they went through the 15 years. I think everyone knew what it was. The fans love turning up. You speak to them now, and some of the stewards that used to work there as well, they loved it because everyone was in it together. Everyone was like, you know, this is what it is. We all muck in. We all stay together. We all muck in.
Did the players embrace it as well? Because I spoke to Bob Booker, who also said it was a dump, but it was your dump.
Our dump. Yeah, exactly. And like you say, you know, if our players didn't really want to play, imagine what the opposition felt like. But we embraced it, really. I think, you know, it became our sort of fortress, our place that no one wanted to come there. We embraced that. Like I said, what was the alternative? We sort of like just go, oh, well, we don't really want to play, so we give up. No, we turned it to our advantage. And like I said, even again at Brighton, going into that squad that I went into, again, another great character squad. You know, some of the players that were there, the characters, Charlie Oakway, Richard Carpenter, Danny Cullett, you know, go through the whole team, Michelle in goal, Kerry Moe, Gary Hart, you know, all through the team. Bobby's more up front than Leon Knight come in. You know, but just character everywhere. Nathan Jones. You know, Paul Watson. It's just character all through the team.
As you said, you obviously got into the team and you ended up becoming first team regular. And that season, you know, you were voted player of the year. and you end up finishing it at the Millennium Stadium. What was that season like?
Yeah, I mean, like I say, start off with obviously Steve Coppell was in charge, and then he went, I think he left to go to Reading or somewhere. And then Mark McGee came in. I think his first game, we lost 4-1 at home to Bristol City, which is, you know, quite funny, really, considering where we ended up playing them at the Millennium. Again, with Mark, he came in, and I sort of, all throughout my career, I mean, by the time I'd sort of signed there, you're talking kind of 2004, I was probably coming up 34, round about then, end of my career. So I pulled Mark and just said to him, look, I'll pull you first of all, Mark. Most managers don't really look at me, you know, big lump, whatever, but don't give me a chance. I said, if you're willing to give me a chance, or if you've got anything you could think that would improve me, I'll listen to it, because don't just fall into that situation where you just, oh, he's a big lump, he's going to be slow, blah, 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 blah. Give me a chance. And to be fair to him, he said, funnily enough, I was going to pull you, he said, because I don't know anyone here in the squad, and I don't know you, he said, but I've played in teams against you. He said, and I know what you can do. He said, so no problem on that front. He said, but if you are really serious about, he said, I was going to pick your brains about a few things. He said, but if you're serious about wanting to get fit or wanting to do this, that and the other, he said, I've could probably extend your career by another 3-4 years. He said, if you really want to buy into it, he said, it'd be hard work. He said, but tomorrow, bring in 2 sets of kit. He said, and I'll meet you here. I think we should train at 10:30. He said, so I'll meet you here at 8:30, something like that. He said, bring 2 sets of kit. So I didn't know what to expect. So I turned up next day, and there's a little gym there with a treadmill and some weights. And he said, right, get on the treadmill. And he said, get it up to a little jog, and then put it down a notch so you're power walking. And when I say power walking, I mean literally, like really stupidly, really swinging your arms and going really, really fast, but walking. He said, do that for an hour. And I'm sort of thinking, an hour? He said, and I'll be back. So 5 minutes, he's disappeared. So 5 minutes in, sweat's coming off my arms and hitting the windows in front of me. I'm sort of looking around thinking, this is a wind-up. And I'm waiting for everyone to jump out and go, like, you know. But I've done it for an hour. I was honestly dripped in sweat. He come in, done a few weights and that, and he said, right. He said, you do that on a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. He said, if you haven't got a midweek game. He said, if you've got a midweek game, don't bother. He said, but Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, you do that. He said, obviously, join in with the training after. That's why you bring 2 kits. He said, and basically do, it's almost similar to the Atkins diet, but not as extreme. He said, but try not to eat vegetables that grow below ground because they've got starch in, blah, 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 blah. He said, but on a Thursday and Friday, lean up to your game. He said, eat what you want. Done that, and within space of a month, I must have lost God knows how much, because we used to get weighed twice a week, and the physio was sort of looking at it. In the end, I didn't really want to be too light, because I wanted to give myself a little bit of a, you know, a leeway, so that if I did put on the odd pound or two, it wouldn't look too bad. I was ended up getting on the scales with some weights in my hands. First time I've done that ever, because I was losing so much weight. I thought, I don't want to lose too much weight, like I say, and they'd moan at me if I put a pound or two on. So I used to get on the scales with a pound weight either in each hand, so it was 2 pounds, you know, but I was still even losing weight even then. This thing, like I say, got me really, really fit, and like proof in the pudding, I got, like you said, player of the year that year. Yeah, done that, and I carried it on for the next year as well. But it got to a stage where my legs were really, really, you know, I was getting like 35, sort of 36, my legs were burning up then, and he said, just do a half hour of it and jog the rest or something, you know what I mean, to break it up a little bit. But it worked brilliant for me. I mean, he was superb for me, Mark. The best thing with it, he could obviously tell that after a while, you know, I was getting tired, and he could tell that. And to keep me going, to keep my mental strength up, he used to devise things in training, like little races. And he'd always cheat. He'd always pull me and go, when I extend my little finger out, you go, and I'll say go just after. So I've got that little split second of a head start on everyone. And I used to win all these races against, you know, like Leon Knight and all them. And they're going, hey, you're winning that. And I'm like, mate, first 5 metres are in your head, and all this rubbish that I'm coming out with. But how good is that of a man manager to actually say that to you? Because you could see that, you know, you're getting a little bit down because you have to keep constantly doing all this extra training. He knew how to sort of give me that lift. It was brilliant, honestly. It was brilliant. And, like, you know, I went on to play till I was 38, thankfully.
Probably looked at you as a bit of a his leader on the pitch, I guess. One of the leaders. Yeah, he had loads of them.
Oh, we had abundance of leaders. I mean, I always remember Danny and Charlie saying, when Steve Coppell was there, he basically let them police the changing room, the older players police the changing room for him. Which, as a manager, when you've got someone like that, players like that that are doing that, it's after battle one for you. You can concentrate on other things, and you ain't got to worry about discipline. You ain't got to worry about certain other things. You know what I mean? So when you've got older players doing all that sort of stuff, and keeping the younger players in check, you know, for a manager, that's gold dust. But we had it going throughout the whole team. It was brilliant.
It was pretty eventful, wasn't it? You had relegations, promotions. It was never dull. And it was during the time as well, the club were really looking forward and pushing for that new stadium. Did you feel at that point that the club were going places?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think every single person who signed for Brighton was told, even managers were told, we're getting the ground, you know, stick with it, blah, 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 blah. This is going to be a club, you know, et cetera. Obviously, Tony came in and took it to another level. But we always knew that there was that aim. And, we, you know, the players as well, we joined in with some of the demonstrations. You know, we want a new ground. I remember playing Wickham away. Might be one of the last games of the season. Matt, all the away support behind the goal, all banners and that. And the players after the game went over, got the banners off of them. We were holding the banners up with them. So we all sort of bought into it. And, you know, we always knew that we needed a new ground. Because, again, at the time, you know, up, down, like you say, eventually... it gets to the stage where you're, you know, the money's running out, and you haven't to sell again. You haven't to sell your players. You know, Bobby's Moore went, Danny Cullett went, Charlie Oakway got injured, had to retire. A few other players go. Adam Virgo scored countless goals for us one season. He goes the following season, and then you're not really replacing that sort of player, if you know what I mean. Ultimately, you're going to start losing games. You're going to start slipping down leagues. But again, you know, the character of the players, we sort of dug in. We all had a go. We all sort of tried and sort of dug in. But ultimately, you're going to come up against teams, like I say, that got better finances than you. And it's just the way it goes. We battled and sort of entertained, etc. And we always bought into that sort of off-the-field stuff as well with the club, trying to get a new stadium. And when it came, it was amazing, really.
A few on the game now, as you watch it, obviously football always evolving. Do you sort of look back at your sort of early career? Do you think that was a better time to play, or is it better now?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I was quite lucky, you know, being up, brought up around that era where, you know, you're watching players of the calibre of Ray Wilkins, you know, Graham Souness, etc. So you sort of brought up in that football, Kennedale Gleeshes and Charlie Nicholas's and all them sort of boys. But, you know, on the flip side, you're talking to Graham Souness, you know, and your Graham Roberts's and all them lot, you know, you did see some robust challenges. And like I said, I've been watching quite a few replays of them games. And I think something did have to change. You know, it's okay going in for a robust challenge, but some of these, I've seen some of the clips and you could tell people ain't generally not even going for the ball, not even getting booked for it, you know. It's mad. You sort of look at them games and think there'd be about six players sent off in them games nowadays. But I still think sometimes it's gone a bit OTT with the way that you can't tackle. I still think that a good time challenge, you know, you get the ball, okay, you're going to catch the man every now and again, but you know, generally know a player that's gone in to hurt someone. You generally know a player that's gone in to win the ball fairly.
If you could influence one thing about the game today, something that niggles you, what would it be?
I think it's to get the VAR sorted. I think it needs an in-depth conversation. I think it's good intentions. The way it was brought in is for all the right intentions, but I think it's got silly in now. I think it's just got ridiculous. You know, people offside by a centimetre or whatever it is. You know, I was sort of brought up in that era where it was, you get some decisions go for you, you get some go against you. Over the season, it normally evens itself out. So, but nowadays, because there's so much money involved in football, I think that everyone's doing it down to the centimetre now because it's the difference between staying up and going down, and there's a lot of money involved in it. But it spoils the game.
With each guest, we have a quick game called Jumpers for Goalposts. In this scenario, you're the captain of a five-a-side team in a nice sunny park, so you're in the team. But of all the players you've played with throughout your career, and it doesn't necessarily have to be with Albion, who would be your first pick?
In goal, I'd probably go for Alan Knight. I played with some great goalkeepers. To be fair, I was lucky. Bobby Mims, Starfoot at Spurs, Eric Torsfed, oh my God, what a legend. Knightsy at Portsmouth, Vince Bartram at Gillingham, Michelle Kuypers and Ben Roberts, obviously at Brighton. But I think Knightsy, because, you know, for someone to play, well, I don't know how many games it was in the end, 900 odd for one club. MBE, you know what I mean? And not only that, great lad as well off the pitch. They all are, to be fair, but, you know, Knightsey, I think I'll get it purely because I want, you know, for the career that he had, I think he deserves to be in there. You know, he sort of, he played it the right way as well. Good humour, you know. He pull off some fantastic saves. He'd make the odd boo-boo, as they all did. But, you know, he'd get on with it. Wouldn't let it eat into him. Get on with it. Good talker behind you as well. So, Knightsey being goal. Obviously, I'll take up one of the centre-half positions then. I'll probably have, to be fair. Again, you know, centre-half position. I've played with some tremendous centre-halves. Gary Mabbott, Terry Fenwick. I'll probably have Mabsy in there. Midfield, best player I've ever played with, Paul Gascoigne. He'd be in there straight away. Best player I've played with by far. I always remember him. He used to have a player man marking him, like, and I mean man marking him, touch tight to him, and I get the ball and he'd still be calling for it. And I think, I can't give it to you. There's a bloke waiting to smash her. So I give it to someone else, and he'd give me the massive rollicking. And after a while, you think, do you know what? I'll give you the ball. If he smashes you, up you, mate. It's up to you. You give him the ball, and he would literally, it would stick to him. He would pin the fella, and the bloke would bounce off him. And then all of a sudden, he'd drop the shoulder, and he's gone. And I've never seen anything like it. And I think, you know, shame he got injured when he did, because he would have been right up there with the best players in the world. But yeah, what a player. Oh, he scored some decent goals as well. So that's, what's that, four?
Oh, yeah.
And I'd have, see, you have to have someone up front. Oh, God, it's getting even harder. Well, I was lucky again to play in the same team as Gary Lineker. You know, record speak for itself, doesn't it? Gary Lineker. Yeah. I mean, then go to Portsmouth, you've got Paul Walsh. Like, Guy Whittenham scored 40-something odd goals one year, broke the record for the goal scoring at Portsmouth. Paul Walsh got player of the year that year. That's how good he was.
Yeah.
You know, and Witts as well, like I say, scoring them goals. I mean, what a team. Gillingham, Bob Taylor, Carlos Arbour, banging goals in for fun. Knightsey, Bobby Zamora, what a player. Oh, you dropped me on it now, wouldn't you? But purely record-wise, I'll probably have to go five-a-side. I would have said Lineker. I'm going Walshy.
Great team. Okay, next one. Hypothetical situation. You're taking over Match of the Day for one episode only. They've told you they can run extended highlights of one match from your time with the Albion. Which one would it be and why?
I think it was 2004-2005 season. Just got promoted to the Championship. West Ham away. 1-0 and I scored the winner. The beauty of it, my dad was a West Ham fan. So he felt like he'd lost the tenner and found a fiver that day, I think. But yeah, so it was, again, not expecting to go there and get anything at all. We turned up at the hotel for the game. There was a bit of a bug going around. So when we get to the game, Danny Cullip's been sick in the changing room. So we had to wait a little bit while that was cleaned up. But he still managed to play, which is the mark of the man. And yeah, they had, you know, the team they had that day, they had, they had some players. Marlon Elwood up front, Don Hutchison, Bobby Zamora come on, Rebrov come on. They had Ferdinand at the back. They had, yeah, a great team. And we beat them 1-0. It was like the Alamo. First 20 minutes, they hit the post. It was goalmouth scrambles, you know, to the stage where you were literally giggling sometimes because it was, you know, you just didn't know how the ball didn't go in. Michel's putting off saves left, right and centre. We're putting our heads in the way, blocking things, booting it. Adam Inchwood at the back as well, you know. Got another young, great player. Vergs, I think Vergs might have been in midfield that game. You know, Chippy, Richard Carpenter, Charlie Oakway, me, Danny. You know, like I said, that team and then players that I mentioned before, just digging in and then eventually getting a couple of corners, getting a couple of little free kicks in good areas. Do you know what I mean? And that, we think that's our only chance, really. We had Steve Claridge on loan. He must have been about 83 at the time. God knows how old he was and how many games he'd played. But, you know, that typical socks down, you know, that but non-stop running. Yep. And we get a free kick. I think we get a free kick wide by the corner flag. Richard Carpenter, we could always rely on Chippy to put the ball in a good area. For some reason, I think Steve Claridge, whether he'd been, because he was only on loan, whether he was clued up about our way that we do set pieces, he come for a short one for some reason. And even another reason why I can't get Chippy played it to him. He gave him the short short ball, and I thought, I ain't come up here for nothing. So you're just thinking, what? So I'm starting to work like as if sort of spin off, as if to think I'm going to work my way back if it don't come off. So I think that gave me a couple of extra yards, and then all of a sudden the ball went back to Chippy and he's put a ball right on the sixpence. And I always remember the defender, I looked at him and I thought, it's going over your head or right above your head, you know, one of them. So I sort of half used him as a bit of a ladder and got the header in, and it went down and skidded off the turf into the net. And all I remember was the whole of the away end just exploding, because we'd literally packed near enough the whole of the away end, and it's just all up in arms. And yeah, what a feeling when you score. But then it gives you something to defend, you know. And after that, I don't really think we got in there after too much after that. Like I say, Bobby Zamora coming on the sub, Rebrov, you know, all these players coming on, trying to get back in the game. And we just, again, bodies on the line, heading it, booting it, just getting out of the way. I think two players got sent off in that game, one on each. And then final whistle. And afterwards, again, in the changing room, all sitting there laughing as we did that season. We beat Sheffield United away. We beat Leicester away. And we used to come in the changing room after just all giggling and laughing, like, how did we win that? How the hell did we win that? But when you've got that team spirit, you know, it's massive.
Right now, a bit of fun, a 1 minute shootout, quick fire questions. They're not all about football, but I'll fire some at you. You give me the first response. So here we go. First of all, with Dean, Goldstone or the Amex?
With Dean.
Tea or coffee?
Coffee.
FA Cup win or avoid top flight relegation in one season?
Avoid relegation.
Book or film?
Film.
VAR or no VAR?
No VAR.
Boat or train?
Train.
Old Wembley or new Wembley?
Old Wembley.
And travel the world or lays on the world's most idyllic beach?
True. That's a good one. That's a good one. I'm not normally one for laying around on a beach, but as I've got older, travel the world.
Okay. tell us something about you which a lot of people don't know.
I was a one-parent family at one stage. When I was at Portsmouth, I looked after my daughter on my own with the help of my mum for 2 years. Because I went legal. This is what I was saying, off-field stuff that happened when I was at Spurs and that. When I first signed for Portsmouth, I had to go to court. Funnily enough, my solicitor was John Ward-Prowse, James Ward-Prowse's dad. How good is that? So I at one stage, I was one-parent family for 2 years when I was at Portsmouth, which was hard work. But yeah. So maybe people don't know that about me, but there you go.
Okay.
But now, you know, happily with my missus now for 25, 26 years. Got another kid as well. So, yeah, brilliant. All worked out at the end.
Yeah, absolutely. Leaving aside sport, what do you do to relax?
Walk the dog quite a bit. By the time I work, because I live in Southampton, by the time I finish down in Brighton, by the time I get home, there's not much else to do, to be fair. Every year, we normally do a bike ride around Europe to raise funds for Albion community. Obviously, we're not doing that this year, so every now and again I get out on the bike, quite like that. It gets you out, you know, and you sort of, it's weird because when you're on a bike, you see a lot more stuff that you never see in a car. So you sort of go down roads and think, well, I never knew this was here, you know. Like, even though you've driven down there, you don't really keep your eyes on the road, don't you? So you don't really have a look around what's around in the fields, etc. But when you're on a bike, it's lovely bit of scenery, especially around here. It's a bit rural, like I say, and you've got the odd farms and that around here. So yeah, bike riding and basically, I like watching a bit of telly.
Tell us about your role that you've got with the Albion at the moment.
At the moment, obviously, it's a bit different because of this lockdown thing. But normally, when on a day-to-day basis, I go down to the Amex. We've got students that have left school. They've come into our college at the stadium. They're doing a diploma in sport, which entails them doing their lessons at the Amex. And then after that, 3 days a week, we get them down to the training ground. And train them up 11 aside for a couple of hours, and then the other 2 days of the week, on a Wednesday and a Friday, we play games against other community teams in a National Youth Football League, and it's quite good. We've Britta Sombalunga started off there at Watford, so it's good standard, and so we do that. And then after they finish the training down at the training ground, we take them back to the ground where they continue on with their lessons. We mentor them as well and help out in the classrooms, and also me and Danny, we help out across most of the departments. We do a little bit for disability, do quite a bit for fundraising. We do stuff for social inclusion. So whenever someone's got something coming up they need, me and Danny come along and help out with there. So yeah, and like I say, a lot of fundraising.
It's something you quite enjoy.
Yeah, love it. Love it. Yeah. It's the beauty of it. I'm getting to meet loads of different people, getting to, you know, lots of different Albion fans. On the lockdown at the moment, we're ringing around all our elderly fans, make sure they're all right, make sure they're looked after, they've got stuff, you know, people are looking after them and helping them out, and they've got all their medicines catered for, etc. You know, everyone in the club's sort of mucking in and doing that, which is brilliant. You know, not many clubs are doing that. And so I'm meeting more and more people via the phone. I didn't realise they try and put it in specific areas, and I've got a lot of people in the Southampton area. I never knew there's so many Brighton fans over this way. Got some on the Isle of Wight, so it's brilliant. And just chat to them. One of them lives 3 minutes away from me,
really?
And I've vowed to meet up with him for a beer when all this is finished. It's brilliant. Like I say, I'm a people's person, so when I sort of talk to them on the phone and meet more Brighton fans, I love hearing people's stories. Mm. Like listening to their own stories, if you know what I mean. Mm. They like listening to a few of mine, but I like listening to where they come from, you know, how long they've been supporting the Albion for, things like that. Love it.
Last couple, what's your honest professional summing up of the Albion since they got to the Amex? And what do you think their long-term potential is?
Oh, I think they've done outstanding. I mean, Tony's come in, like I say, and taken the club onto another level. And Paul Barber, obviously, you know, the job that they've done has been fantastic. The stadium, you know, every time I go there, I sort of pinch myself and, really, like you said before, realise where we've come from the Wisden. To what it is now, you know, filling out 30,000 people every week. It's just amazing. I think the potential's there certainly to be another sort of like a Burnley or a Bournemouth, you know, make ourselves established, well established in that division. And then maybe get the odd year like a Sheffield United or a Leicester, who knows, you know, maybe that one year where we just hit it right. Who knows? That's the beauty of it. When you see what Leicester did, you know, every single club in that division now has got to be looking at it. And looking at Sheffield United, you know, looking what they've done, every single club in that division has got to be thinking this is possible for us to do. Like I say, just hopefully just keep it going. Fingers crossed this season's not too much of a disruption. It's not disrupted too much in the fact that they're going to try and do things, you know. I hope it doesn't get spoiled. Maybe it's a case of just drawing a line under it and starting afresh. And then fingers crossed we can crack on again, because I think with the fans there, with the setup behind the scenes, with the players there and the manager certainly, I think, you know, it's exciting times for everyone looking forward for Brighton.
Finally, do you have a message for the Albion fans?
Yeah, just stay safe at the moment. Obviously, it's weird times. I mean, no one's ever been through this before, but make sure you're staying safe. And again, you know, if you do need any help, I'm pretty sure you contact the Albion. You know, they've got people out in the community still working and helping out. And, you know, just like you say, if you need any, even people to ring you up, just a little phone call or whatever, just to make the time go a little bit better, then please be in contact, because I'm more than willing to ring people up. No problem.
Guy, thank you so much for your time.
No problem. I've thoroughly enjoyed it.
Great to speak to Guy. A common theme developing with interesting stories coming from Mark McGee. A good Jumpers for Goalposts team too. Thanks so much for listening. Please do spread the word, retweet, share and subscribe. I'll be back next week. Bye for now.